in terms of treatment, people live long, healthy lives now, right? Like, and that's what we want people to know, is HIV is not a death sentence. Some folks still think that. You don't need to be afraid of HIV, but you do need to know if you have it, because it is something that's doing damage and you don't even realize it. And by the time you realize it, it's a lot more difficult to treat. It's still possible, but it's a lot more difficult to treat. And there's a lot of damage that's been done at that point. So I really encourage people, if you think you've been at risk because of, sex or substance use or anything like that, go to selftest.kady.ca. In terms of scaling back, some of us who have adequate funding, like my organization, Kady, we're a big national knowledge broker. We run an ordering center regardless, right? So we have an ordering center where you can go and order all kinds of information about HIV, Hep C, and the overdose crisis, and get information there. We already have that infrastructure in place. So we will continue to offer the self-test kits, and we'll find some way to pay for the shipping. Now, are we going to be able to go out and buy radio ads in Indigenous communities like we had in the past? Will we be able to, promote these test kits online and in person in certain communities that need to know about them? No, that's where we'll see a retraction, not just from Kady, but from our frontline organizations. And that's the trouble, is that the highly motivated people will find these test kits, right? But they're not this last, you mentioned the 95, 95, 95 goals, right? Well, we're about 90 in terms of testing. So we're talking about 10% of folks have HIV and don't know it, or rather 10% of people with HIV don't know it. And we need them to get tested. And if they're not getting tested, there's a reason for that, right? Either they don't trust the system, they don't think they're at risk, they don't have availability to an HIV test, their auntie is the one who does the test. Like, there are a number of barriers. This test kit offered one of those, but we were also using the funding to address some of those other barriers as well.
I think it's I implore our listeners, if they feel that, like you said, due to sex or drug use or any of the other risk factors that they feel they may it might be worthwhile, please go out and get tested. Because it puts your loved ones at risk as well, and that's really and to bring it back to kind of the big global picture, is if everyone who has HIV is aware of it, then we can, slow down and hopefully stop the kind of unwitting spread of HIV. And that's really the goal. The best way to end this is to know. Knowledge is going to be the power here. Now, it's interesting because you folks are a bit of a knowledge broker on this subject, especially with the government of Canada. You mentioned that you were hoping that with this investment, you can prove that it works, and fingers crossed that translates to, Health Canada and the federal government, particularly the politicians. 8 million, that's, one wheel on an F-30 jet, you know what I mean? Like,
Yeah,
that's
and we're talking, this is spread out across the nation, 10 provinces, three territories, hundreds of organizations. $8 million was not a lot of money. You're right. And I hope the next couch cushion they turn over is a bigger one. And I'm encouraged. I'm glad to hear that they told you that they were going to try to look for some money. I ran into the Minister of Health recently. He committed to a meeting in April, and he asked me to bring forward a proposal from the sector to how we're going to get to 2030. So we're working with our national partners. We meet as a national advocates group to kind of hammer out what exactly we think will ensure that we meet our commitments, those 95, 95, 95 targets. But also, the goal is elimination in 2030, which, we know we will never completely eradicate HIV and hepatitis C, but it's possible to make them controlled and no longer public health threats like we have done other illnesses. So we're certainly we're optimistic that they're going to live up to their commitments around that.
Well, I just want to confirm that we had a statement sent to us by the press secretary for the Minister of Health. And I'll quote here, "And we are exploring all options going forward, end quote. So, and then PHAC, the Public Health Agency of Canada, said something very similar in terms of trying to find the funds. Now, I will clarify that no one in the government has referenced checking the couch cushions. That may have been may have been a little embellishment on my end. So we won't to that point. But I think the point is really there. And we know that the UK and a lot of other countries are doing huge progress on addressing the spread of HIV. And fingers crossed, Canada can do so too. Do you have any closing comments that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yeah, I just want to build on that last point you made, which is we are a very wealthy country. We should not be seeing things like congenital syphilis or syphilis at all in our country. People shouldn't be getting HIV anymore. We have the tools we need. We just have to employ them. And I think that's really important for people to understand. I think sometimes these things seem so daunting, and it is. But the reality is we don't have to do the research on developing these tools. We've got them. We know how to prevent HIV. We know how to treat it. We're just really, now it's a people issue. We've got to connect people to care. And that's across the board. This next push, I like to remind people, like, this is the hardest, right? We got the low-hanging fruit, the 90%. The last push is going to be the most difficult. It's going to be most complex and the most expensive. So bring your checkbook.
You've inspired another question, though, and a part of me is thinking, you know, we're a gay radio show, and therefore the subject of HIV and AIDS is something that has been consistent for decades. And I think that there are older generations where this very much was front of mind. You know, an anecdote I'll share with our audience is, somebody asked a while ago about why there are so many intergenerational relationships in the gay community. So young folks with much older folks. And it has to do with the fact that an entire generation in the middle were wiped out by the AIDS crisis. And then, you know, things have stabilized, obviously, in the decades that followed. But the HIV and the gay community have been intrinsically linked. And my question really is for you is what's the sense that you're having with this youngest generation, you know, our Gen Z folks, the folks who are entering their, you know, the peak of their sexual lives right now, where this hasn't necessarily been a front page news topic. It may not have permeated the culture in the way it has previous generations. I realize this is very much a left field question from the interview, but I think when we're talking about that last 10%, you know, new folks entering the world of adult fun times, you know, how do we make sure that those folks are also safe, sane, and consensual?
Yeah, you're right. And so that's sex ed. Right. Or that's like community organizations talking about sexual health. And we know that that's like highly political in this country. And any type of sex ed is very politicized. And if you try to put queer sex in there, it becomes even more politicized. And we're seeing those battles happening across the country. And I think, then that leaves a few options for people to learn about HIV prevention and sexual health, because it's not just HIV, right? Like you've got to test for other things. And I think, I don't know, I'm optimistic around that. I don't think we see the same divide around age. I think where we see it is around privilege. And there are privileged young folks that are have private healthcare or have access to prevention options, either through, you know, their work or their public program. But where we're seeing it more is around lines of it really whether or not you're connected to care. So like, and there are communities that aren't connected to care. And that's where we're seeing more HIV infections now. It's no longer bankers, doctors, people like that. They're able to go out and access the prevention tools they need. So what it means is it's not impacting gay men in the same way, But it is still impacting some gay men. We know racialized gay men, a lot of new immigrants, people who may not understand the language well. Like there are certain pockets of HIV, and that's why community organizations are best served to reach them.
Now, I know that in the statement we got from Katie on this, it references the 6,500 estimated indigenous folks who are currently believed to be undiagnosed with HIV. And I believe one of your board members has kind of really stepped up to be able to speak on this. But pivoting a little bit, in my final question here to indigenous folks, and you mentioned those targeted radio ads. Is this a hard to reach population where this money and this funding has hopefully made a difference?
So is it a hard to reach pop? Are Indigenous folks hard to reach? Not all Indigenous folks, certainly not. But rural, remote, isolated folks, people that may not be connected to care because they've been displaced for whatever reason, intergenerational trauma, substance use, these things are not just unique to Indigenous folks. They're also like queer communities experience higher rates of those things as well. And we know that HIV thrives in those type of environments. And so yes, Indigenous people are disproportionately impacted by HIV in this country. And certainly we had a number of Indigenous groups who were involved in the self-testing project and distributing it, and will continue to be in some capacity, but that will probably be reduced.
Well, fingers crossed that the government is hearing this. At the very least, I will forward our interview over to the minister, and maybe they'll be inspired to check those couch cushions. All right, we'll be back a little late in the show with the executive director of the Canadian AIDS Society as well on this. Thank you so much, Jody, for joining us, and we'll be back just after. Welcome back to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. We are diving into the subject of at-home HIV self-testing kits this week. And joining me, I'm very excited to have Ken Miller, who is the executive director of the Canadian AIDS Society. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, thank you very much for including us on this important issue.
Well, as we mentioned in the top of the show, the federal government had provided about 8 million in the first round, 8.6-ish in the second round, to get these at-home self-testing kits into the hands of those who, would make the most use of them. Now, the government isn't going door-to-door saying, would you like a self-test kit? They're relying on agencies such as yours and agencies such as your members to distribute these kits. Can you tell us a little bit about how Canadian AIDS Society and your members have rolled out this program?
Yeah, so I mean, like, as far as Canadian AIDS Society involvement, we haven't been extensively involved in this specific project. We're really involved along the lines of like International Testing Week or International Testing Day, like campaigns and such. So really I have to give it to like CBRC, Katie, and Reach, who are really spearheading and CAN for spearheading this project. It's really quite amazing and has a lot of impact. In terms of our member organizations though, this actually comes as very unfortunate news, right? So we're talking about the community organizations who are the folks on the ground who are really rolling this out and ensuring that the test kits are getting to where it needs to go. And at a time when people are, I guess you can say, prioritizing HIV less and less, which means funding is being eroded, I just don't see the benefit of continuing to erode that funding, but also continuing to expect the services are provided by those same organizations, right? It puts further stress on the system. It harms the ability to actually care for the people that we're here for within the movement. And I think it'll have a large impact on like those populations that are really depending on this type of project or this program, right?
I think that's an excellent point. Now, we asked the ED of Katie earlier about, what happens when the funding stops, and they indicated that hopefully they'll continue. I believe that they will continue to distribute the kits, but, we'll have to somehow absorb all of those costs. And I think that's what we're talking about here, an expectation from potentially the government here that these agencies will continue to provide the service, but maybe the government no longer wants to pay for them. In a sector that struggles with burnout, in a people-serving sector, what kind of impact is that going to have on your members? This expectation that, maybe there's no more government support coming, but, there is perhaps a misplaced belief that these agencies will continue to do the work anyway.
I think in terms of our members, they want to provide these services. And so that expectation is like probably not going offhand or whatever, right? Like, I think it's probably safe to say they will do their best and they will roll this out as possible. But that strain that's already on the sector is somewhat unfair to just expect to continue on, right? Mm-hmm. I think really another piece that I would like to speak about is where else are we going to see this impact? Right? What are the communities actually going to, how are these communities going to be impacted? Right? So if we look at this organizational impact, there's also the person impact, right? So looking at what are the histories, where is the history of harm that actually affects communities from not participating with regular healthcare settings, right? How are these communities going to be affected by a program that actually allowed them to continue service without interacting with those previously harmful or even currently harmful kind of institutions, right? This is one of the best workarounds I've ever seen for having to, for being able to have a service and not fully go into these situations that can be incredibly uncomfortable.
Being able to just find out at home, that can be a game changer. That can really go, you can go from being unaware to tested and knowing, and knowledge is absolutely key and fundamental here. We touched a little bit on Indigenous folks earlier, but I think it's interesting because it's not just Indigenous folks, it's anyone who hasn't had sort of historical ongoing access to frontline healthcare.
Well, it's a continuity of care, right? Because if somebody does test positive, I mean, autonomy in their own decision to move forward is important, but also the ability and the knowledge that it's possible to move forward is equally as important, right? We have an incredibly important a project that the Public Health Agency has recently funded around U equals U, undetectable equals untransmittable. This is a huge message to be able to get into the hands of folks. But finding out you can be undetectable is not like really beneficial if you're never able to get tested to know you have HIV in the first place. One thing needs to lead to the other, and the opportunity to have the services in between is incredibly important to the continuity of care and the outcome of like a more positive life and mental health and well-being for everyone involved and impacted.
Each year they've dropped about 8 million on this, which to the layperson is an awful lot of money, but to the the federal government of Canada is it's a rounding error on a COVID benefit. You know what I mean? Like it's not a huge amount. How optimistic are you that not only there's a bit of a two-part question. How optimistic are you that not only can this initiative, the at-home testing and the getting these kits into the hands of folks, can be proven to be effective and work, but also how optimistic are you that that evidence will result in ongoing or further funding?
I mean, even just looking at like, I'm in a remote and rural area, right? I'm outside of Thunder Bay, Ontario, in a town. We don't have a clinic in this town. It's not that far for me to go and get services. But when I worked in that frontline service at Elevate NWO, we did road shows outside of the city, right? And so this was interesting because we went to many different communities. We could drive from one side of the catchment area to the other 9.5, 10 hours, right? Having the opportunity to receive care from an outside source once or twice a month was huge for them, but also just not enough, right? Bringing in this next layer of a self-test kit where people are now able to be provided those services on their own terms throughout the entire year when they don't have access is so much more important. Looking at people in Toronto, how many times or places can you go to get this service? Ample, everywhere, right? Maybe not everywhere, I shouldn't say that, but quite often. Places are like this, we're talking every few months, a couple times a year, where some folks are comfortable enough to access those services, right? Huge, huge difference. And so if the service is not further allowed in areas like this especially, we're not going to have a full picture of like what the impact is or the kind of care that we need to provide even.
Well, hopefully the federal government can see that this works. The sense I've gotten from yourself and from Katie is the outreach has been really targeted towards not the populations that are already quite well served, but specifically the populations who are unserved or underserved, and this could be a huge benefit.
I really hope that folks see the benefit to this. And yeah, we always need help advocating for these types of things. And so anyone that does see the benefit, please reach out to your MPs, your MPPs, government officials, talk to somebody, right? Make it a point to really push this issue forward, because changes don't happen if nobody's talking about it.
Thank you so much, Ken, for joining us. It's greatly appreciated. And we'll be back just after this. And that was our great discussion earlier with the Canadian Aid Society. Now, As I mentioned, we had Teeth by Ruby Doom play a little earlier in the show, and we have run out of time, but I wanted to give folks a bit of a heads up on some of the other things that we are working on. Over the next month or so, we'll be doing a dive into the health of LGBT businesses. We have a couple of interviews lined up on that one. Dr. Tom Hooper, from who really helped to expose the allegations of fraud against the Toronto Pride, will be coming in and joining us and talking about that. Lots more content coming from it. We are also working on a newsletter that folks can subscribe to, where we will capture the gists of our big conversation topics, such as the role or the non-renewal of the funding for these HIV self-kits. You can go to queer.news to find more details. We're playing out with Courage by Mitchell McCoons. I have been Luke Smith.
And I've been Sebastian. And thank you for listening.
Think about his money, if I'm gonna make it, if I should even try to find my way, navigate the water, time is in question, I need help. Creator, give me courage, 'cause I'm scared as hell, everything keeps changing, I'm unsure of myself. Don't know where I'm going, but I know just what to find, looking for on disappearing days, I wonder if the red road will let me take a break from these chains. I'm too young to be helpless, scared of being selfish and treating you that way. Creator, give me courage, 'cause I'm scared as hell. Everything keeps changing, I'm unsure of myself. Don't know where I'm going, but I know just where.